So good evening and welcome to the closing plenary of Left Forum 2017. My name is Rob Robinson. I'm one of the members of the board of directors of this conference, and I hope you enjoyed the experience this weekend. We worked hard to put this together for you. So. We are coming to the end of another successful forum. We had close to 350 panels and workshops and over 1,100 speakers from all over the world. As with prior conferences, old relationships were rekindled and many new ones were made. The Left Forum gave space to young voices which are leading the struggles of resistance, and we featured the voices of women doing incredible work on the ground. I was personally asked this evening if Left Forum could seriously consider prioritizing the voices of the Palestinian struggle. And I assured that I was sure to ensure that individual that that would be a rich discussion on future board meetings within the Left Forum. We will not ignore any request made of us. And on that matter, I'd like to ask you to take the time this coming week as we send you an email, if you're on our email list, to fill out a survey. Tell us what you liked about this forum, what you didn't like, what we could do better, and what we need to add. We want to hear from you. This forum is not for us. We do it for you, right? So we need to hear your voice in the struggle. If you're not on our mailing list, you can visit our website at www.leftforum.org, and you can fill out that survey, or you could also join our mailing list at the same time. Finally, on behalf of the Board of Directors, we'd like to thank our co-directors, Ashley Abbott and Marcus Gretsch, for an incredible job putting together this organizing conference. Incredibly, those are the only two staff people at Left Forum. The rest of the work is done by a core group of volunteers, short-term and long-term, and I think they deserve a round of applause. It is with dedication and commitment that all of this comes off. And that group, you know, we don't look to abuse labor, but it takes resources to make this conference happen. So on that note, if any of you know me, I have no problem doing what we call an organizing and ask, right? And on your seat is an envelope that looks like this. And we're asking you to make a donation to the Left Forum. Any amount can help, but I will say this. We need this as part of the operations of Left Forum. It is expensive to put this conference together, and the resources that we take in don't necessarily pay for what we put out in product. So with that, please consider being a sustained donor also, and you can do that by visiting our website and making a small donation. If we want to make social change, the resources have to come from us. If you rely on philanthropy to make change, philanthropy has its own agenda, folks, and I'll just be very clear about that. So finally, we came up with the theme of this conference, and we want to know whether resistance and revolution, what comes after that? That doesn't always lead to change. Many of us, and I call myself a practitioner of direct action and civil disobedience. If you know me, there's nothing I like better doing than taking over vacant buildings and using them for the purpose that they were built for, to house people, right? So in this economy and the way things work, we have to look for social change. But social change doesn't only come from revolution and resistance. We have to have a vision. So we need to have a clear vision, and we need to know how to obtain that vision. So hopefully this plenary session tonight will answer that. I'm going to introduce the moderator, and the moderator will introduce the rest of the speakers, and then we'll close out this amazing Left Forum 2017. So Bhaskar Sankara is the founding editor and publisher of Jacobin, a left-wing quarterly magazine based in New York. It is often described as a leading voice of the American left, offering socialist perspectives on politics, economics, and culture. He writes for Vice magazine, The Washington Post, The Nation, among other outlets. Please join me in welcoming Bhaskar Sankara.
Thank you all for coming. I just wanted to say thanks to all the organizers. It's actually With Jack and Matt, we reorganize maybe one event every 2 months with like three or four speakers, and it's always a headache, so I can't imagine the staggering scale of everything here this weekend. So I actually was not under the impression that I would introduce all the panelists, so I didn't solicit bios. So the panelists are going to do, actually, you know, I have the bios, but the panelists are going to introduce themselves briefly with a line or two because, you know, that's more communist or something. We'll just go with that story. So the topic we're discussing here is very, very broad. It's, you know, beyond capitalism, where to go to from here. And each speaker has a pretty, you know, distinct area of expertise and thing they focus on. But I think there is a few common threads uniting them. And, you know, we'll flesh this out hopefully towards the end of the panel. But what I mean by that is that I think we're at a point where a lot of the old debates we had kind of reform or revolution kind of within capitalism, outside of capitalism, are less relevant today, and it's more a question of what does it mean to be an anti-capitalist today and how does it change the way we approach certain concrete issues. So in other words, along the same lines, do we look through philanthropy, do we look through notions of like green capitalism or whatnot, or do we try to build movements from the bottom up that have at their core the idea that, you know, workers have distinct interests different than elites, and we need our institutions of struggle and resistance to kind of reflect that logic. So with that, I guess we'll start with Christian Parenti, who is one of the people I could introduce off the top of my head, because he's written frequently for Jacobin and Dissent and a whole host of other venues. But Christian, I guess, along those lines, particularly a lot of your work recently has focused on the question of environmentalism and the role that the state should play in trying to think about what a anti-capitalist environmental movement would do kind of within capitalism. So obviously it'd be nice to have a revolution, but if climate change is this acute, immediate thing, what do we do today to kind of ameliorate that? So I guess in particular, I was wondering if you can kind of take it from there and in particular focus on this role of what it means to interact with the state, but in a way that's different than kind of the way a liberal would interact with the state, but mm-hmm. use the state to still wield it to achieve certain things.
Mm-hmm. So thanks to everyone for coming out and to all the organizers, and thanks for that question. Whether or not we're talking about socialism or capitalism, even within capitalism, there's a large sort of shadow of socialism, right? There's the public sector, there's the state. And the state has been really crucial in the history of capitalism in sort of developing it. And capitalism, not sort of developing it, in driving its development. And so immediately there's a lot that the state can do even within capitalism. Let's say there was a socialist revolution, whatever exactly that would mean, a mixed economy or everything being decommodified, there's still basic problems around climate change, which I think the left often, environmental left at least, doesn't deal with. And that has to do with the role of technology primarily. So if we begin with the science of climate change, and another key problem related to all this is the kind of cynicism that develops when thinking about climate change. So the basic science is that we are at 405 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere, and the tipping points at which the environmental system of the planet begins to unravel and go beyond our control is 350 parts per million. So we have to not just stop emitting CO2 gases from burning fossil fuels into the atmosphere, we have to draw down radically the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. People realize that that's what science implies, they become very cynical and they detach. There's a line within environmental thinking that there's no techno fix, because the system is constantly sort of suggesting that technology will bail us out. And what this line, no techno fix, means is that technology alone won't solve the problem. There has to be a change in social relations. That's absolutely true. But sometimes no techno fix slides into technology is bad. And people start thinking, well, technology is not part of the solution. And technology very much has to be part of the solution. And I say this as someone who's not on Facebook, not on Twitter, doesn't like technology. But here's the key technology that I think a socialist state or socialist demands of the capitalist state should be thinking about along with renewable energy is this idea, and this is verboten essentially to say in the environmental movement, carbon capture and sequestration. Now, why is that verboten? Because generally, this technology is used to justify further burning of fossil fuels. But here's an important thing. The technology exists already to strip CO2 out of the atmosphere. That technology has existed since the 1930s. You couldn't run submarines without it. But now, in the last couple of years, it's become very easy to turn CO2 not into a gas, which is dangerous and can leak out and kill people, but into a solid, basically into a kind of carbonate rock that's very much like limestone. The problem is capitalism is going to be incapable, or maybe not capitalism, maybe capitalist society, the capitalist state could do this, but like the market forces are incapable of bringing this technology to scale. And that the scientists and the business people who are experimenting with this are trying to think about, oh, how we can market this limestone as building material. It's ridiculous. And what we have in this situation is, it's worth explaining how this stuff works. What it involves stripping CO2 out of the atmosphere, mixing it with hydrogen sulfate in pressurized water, and then injecting it into basalt rock formations. Basalt rock is one of the most common forms of rock. And within 2 years, that turns into a solid. And this is what's called enhanced weatherization. It's basically an acceleration of a natural process. So we have the technology to actually pull ourselves back from the brink of these tipping points. The thing is, the market isn't going to deliver, right? The only way that can be brought to scale is if there are public programs to do this. If the state steps in to buy this technology from the private firms that currently own it, or seize it from them and make it open source. And there's not going to be any way to like make a profit off of doing this at the scale that's necessary. I don't want to go on and on and on, but that point, while it might be kind of seem strangely technical, I think is actually very important because it combats cynicism, right? To realize that we actually have all the technology we need for climate adaptation and mitigation, not just solar energy and electric cars, et cetera, but even this ability to get down back to 350 parts per million. But the market isn't going to deliver that. It has to be treated as a kind of infrastructure, a kind of public atmospheric public works program. So that's my current thinking on technology and climate change and both the sort of reformist developmentalist state within capitalism or, socialism and how it would deal with the climate crisis.
Just a quick follow-up to that. Obviously, there's still the question of kind of agency. Like, who is the political force that will rally around these demands to do it? Do you feel like in the environmentalist movement today, is there this kind of tension between the fact that we need emissions to drop, and that has certain implications as far as personal consumption, particularly considering, a lot of people in the world and, either don't have enough or a lot of people are struggling and want more, and that's been kind of one of the main impulses that we've used in the socialist movement for a century and a half, kind of appealing to those feelings and sentiments, and the need for a kind of it's not constraint, but understanding the planet has limits. Is there a tension there?
Yeah, there is. I mean, this is the idea of green austerity. And, I reject that for a number of reasons. One, it's not going to work to be like, hi, I'm with the eco-socialists. We're here to lower your standard of living, right? That's a political non-starter. And many people need a higher standard of living. And one of the key good things about this transition off of fossil fuels is solar energy, right? The fact of the matter is that the Earth is bombarded every day by more energy than human civilization has used in its entire existence. So there is one resource that is literally infinite. It would be impossible for us to run out of solar energy. So if this economy, or on the way to a socialist economy, or a socialist economy, can increase the energy content of things, there's actually a strong case to be made on the basis of existing technology for how there can be many more jobs and a higher standard of living for many people around the world. And an example of what I mean by increasing the energy technology of something. Think about farming and how we have to adapt. In climate discussions, there's always this idea of adaptation and mitigation. We have to mitigate the problem, i.e. get off fossil fuels, euthanize the fossil fuel industry, build out a renewable energy infrastructure. That's mitigation of the problem. Adaptation means dealing with the changes that we're locked in for, be they social and physical. So food production is going to take a serious hammering. And there are already existing technologies, proven technologies, that can deal with this. There's a massive indoor farm in Newark. There's an indoor shrimp farm up in Newburgh. The problem with these is that they use enormous amounts of energy, and that energy currently comes primarily from fossil fuels. But if there was a solar and renewable energy economy and infrastructure, there would be no problem with increasing the amount of energy content in food, in building materials, whatever else. So that, I think, is, again, kind of abstract, but an important fact and idea for pushing back against this green austerity. It's like that everyone has to consume less. It's like, no, the way we produce and what we consume has to change. But there is, in fact, the source of life on this planet is this infinitely giving source of energy. And we have to harness that and turn it into other things. And that actually would be the basis for a pretty profound socialist prosperity.
Rick, a lot of your recent work has focused around cooperatives and on these kind of questions of how do we create living examples of worker control today and how do we bring those projects up to scale. Now, I guess the question is, obviously cooperatives have a deep lineage in the U.S. and on the left in particular, but is there a way in which we could imagine cooperatives kind of themselves folding into a certain type of American small business mythology? Is there a way, in other words, like how do we relate this cooperative movement that we want to grow and expand to political ideology in a way to prevent it from kind of being subsumed by that and maintaining some sort of anti-capitalist core?
Well, I guess my reaction would be that anything and everything that has ever been tried by the left runs that risk. It can be bent, absorbed, co-opted, shifted, redirected to become a support for the system in which it develops or to become a new system. So there's always the question. Most of us know, I think, that if you look at the history of the Soviet Union or China, there are two major ways of defining socialism. One was to socialize the means of production, and the second one was to substitute planning for markets. For most of the last 100 years, that's what socialism and capitalism have distinguished themselves. And that didn't work out quite in the way that the people who made those courageous revolutions had hoped. Turned out there were ways in which that either was not the right thing to do, or what I find more persuasive, it wasn't enough. You could have the state take over the ownership and operation of enterprises. They did that to an extent. And you could have planning overwhelm or substitute for markets, and they did that often too. Not as much as the Western press likes to suggest, but they did it. But they didn't do something, and that's where the co-op, the worker co-op, comes in. They didn't transform the workplace. You know, it's very different to take the enterprise and move it from private to state, and to transform the workplace is a different thing. If you don't transform the workplace, then what ends up happening is you've gotten rid of the shareholders and the board of directors that they elect, and you've substituted government officials and the party that sends them down. But they then run the enterprise not so differently from the way it was run before. And now I'm going to push it. I think when I read Karl Marx, who I always have found to be a wonderful teacher, that's what he taught. The issue is how you organize the workplace, how you organize production. He wrote endlessly about that. He wrote next to nothing about the role of socialization of property and even less about planning. That's a hint. So maybe, so I don't want to take too much time, so maybe the big lesson to learn about where we go from here in capitalism is to do what people like us ought to be doing, which is to see what were the achievements and what were the shortcomings of the previous experiments to go beyond capitalism, and the most important of those were those in the socialist and communist countries. And for me, it was that not transforming the workplace, not adding to the socialization of property and the planning instead of markets, the real transformation, the turning over of the workplace so it becomes a democratic community where all the workers have an equal say and discuss and debate, doing in the workplace pretty much what the idea of political democracy meant in the residential community. And Bhaskar's right. This is not a new idea. It's certainly not a new idea in the United States, but it isn't a new idea anywhere. Cooperative ways of producing are thousands of years old. Every continent had them. So it's a question of recognizing that human beings have longed for such arrangements of production for a long time. And that maybe there was a necessity to go through one after the other failure to transform. Because think of it, slavery has the master and the slave. Feudalism has the lord and the serf. And we make a revolution and we get employer and employee. If they look parallel to you, good, that's the point. That was Marx's point, to be fair. So for me, the interest in the worker co-op is precisely where we have to go, because it is the logical inference from the previous experiments of people very much like us, in circumstances not so different from today, breaking through, whether it was in 1917 or 1949, that making a movement that people could respond to, get caught up in, because it seemed to make sense as the next step beyond the capitalism that wasn't working for them. That's why I do that. And yes, you have to worry that any step you take, any focus that you put your energy to, could be deflected, could be undone, could be... But that's not more true of worker co-ops than it is of anything else the left has ever proposed.
Rick, in your vision, with these, there would be firm failure, though, obviously, right?
There would.
And
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
So firm failure, like... worker co-ops would go out of business if they...
Absolutely.
So I guess, is there a potential tension there if we... And of course, I'm playing devil's advocate. But is there a potential tension if these firms are run more democratically internally? Like they're electing management, there's full sharing of profits, the workers are less alienated internally... But because they're still competing with each other and subject to certain pressures, it doesn't create in society a wider, solidaristic type of economy?
Well, competition is of many types and sizes and shapes. You can't use the word in the singular. It's how you organize competition. In our economy today, there's all kinds of areas where we limit competition in all kinds of ways. To use the word in a general way implies some uniformity. It isn't any. If it were of a concern to reproduce an economy based on worker co-ops, you would limit, shape, control the competition so it reproduces that system. Because that's exactly what capitalism has done. Shaped, controlled, and defined competition so that it is not disruptive of the underlying system. That's why when a firm doesn't have enough customers, it goes out of business, it dissolves, there's all procedures, legal and otherwise, to make sure that the thing reforms as another capitalist enterprise. That's precisely what would not happen in a worker co-op society, because it would arrange for things to be handled when there isn't enough demand. That would reproduce the co-op social structure and economic structure. That's what's always happened. Feudal society had competition. Slave society had competition. But it was very different because in each case it was designed to reproduce that system, and the worker co-ops would do the same.
So I guess we're moving from a broader, a little bit more abstract, big picture kind of visions of a transition from this sort of economy that we have to something else. But I guess I want to shift to more kind of concrete questions of politically how do we organize to get there. So first of all, Tasha, I do want you to introduce yourself and all your work around Bernie campaign and other things. But just my kind of question is, what type of and form of organization do we want? There's been new initiatives like Our Revolution that are definitely getting some traction and some attention, but they haven't really continued on the kind of immediate outburst of energy we had around the Bernie Sanders campaign. There's other models that are a little bit more centrifugal, like the horizontal models came out of Occupy, and obviously those petered out too. So I kind of wonder, what do you think this kind of worker-led, socialist or otherwise anti-capitalist movement and form should it take? Like, is there some in-between horizontalism and going back to, you know, democratic centralism?
Great question. Well, just a little bit of background because it'll help inform that question. I started, I think, my formal political work as an organizer on the Obama campaign in 2008. And worked on some campaigns after that, a Senate runoff, and then a New York education campaign, and did that for a while. But pretty quickly got burnt out on campaign lifestyle, and also realized pretty quickly that I was much more passionate about the grassroots and how to work in the grassroots and be a part of the grassroots building collective power rather than helping one person build power. Or one small group build power. And after that, I did do some stuff with Occupy, shortly after Occupy, did some volunteering for Zephyr Teachout when she ran for governor, and that really kind of got me back into the organizing mode, but from a purely grassroots perspective. And so when Bernie Sanders announced that he was running, I knew pretty quickly that I wanted to do something there, and had the good fortune of meeting somebody who suggested we start a Brooklyn for Bernie group, which we did, and a lot of people showed up to it. And just based on my experience prior to that, having worked on something like the Obama campaign that had this massive influx of volunteers, to working on smaller campaigns where it was a real struggle, seeing the number of people more than a year before the primary show up, more than a year before the general election, show up to a volunteer meeting, it was immediately obvious to me that this was a huge opportunity. And I thought right in the moment, and I still think I was right, Bernie could have won. And I'll talk a little bit more about like the primary, because I think he could have won the primary. But basically, co-founded a group called Team Bernie NY, and which became a bit of a volunteer network throughout New York City. There was a ton of grassroots momentum in the city, as I'm sure many of you are a part of. And then after the primary, we sort of wound down that group. And since about January or February of this year, I've been involved with DSA, Democratic Socialists of America, in the electoral working group. So that's my background. I think the question of what organizing model we need is a really good question. I think a lot of times people talk about organizing, and that in itself is this word that's thrown around, and I think a lot of people, you know, maybe don't know what it means, especially people who aren't, you know, part of the political process yet. And I think it's a really good word to break down a little bit. Right now, I think you mentioned Our Revolution. There are many other groups like that that have this what's being called big organizing model. The idea there is that there's a sort of central national coordination that's making big asks to local volunteers. So You've probably gotten many emails, sign up here, donate here, and we'll give you some marching orders at some point in time. Some of these groups are a little more specific than others. Obviously, our revolution grew out of the Bernie campaign, so it's a little more specific there. And then, as you mentioned, on the other end, you have this sort of total horizontal structure like Occupy. When I did stuff on Occupy, it was actually my organizational nightmare. I'm a pretty organized, meticulous person, and there were a lot of amazing things about Occupy. I think Occupy gave us a vocabulary and a language and a way to talk about what we needed, what kind of change we needed. And in that, and it's funny, when Occupy happened, that was the biggest critique. People were like, what do you want? What do you want? It's so unclear. And yet now, many years later, that's, to me, the clearest thing that came out of Occupy was it created this 99% language, this very clear goal of what we need. And I think that actually the Bernie movement gave an opportunity for all of us to start to learn how to organize in the grassroots. So Occupy really is one extreme, and I think these sort of big organizing models, websites, are the other extreme. And I definitely think it doesn't have to be either or. There is a middle ground. And I think, to talk about cooperative working for a second, I think the two biggest problems of a big organizing model are, one, that the strategy is built from the top without the information from the bottom. And I also think that the ownership of the work, the product of all of the work of people on the ground, knocking on doors, making calls, talking to their neighbors, building community, ultimately, all of that work, the product of that, ends up getting owned by a very small number of people at the top, and that's a problem. And when we're on the left, we're talking about ownership of our work and control of our work and building collective power. That's not building collective power in my mind. That's building power for a few people at the top who can say, we have all these volunteers and they're going to do what we tell them to do. But we're at the end of the day, we're owning all of that data, all of that really valuable, important voter data that those people knock on doors to collect. So, in my mind, there needs to be more of a structured, organized model that allows groups to grow and scale and build community, but also own all of their work.
That's a lot, and that's well put, I think. But I guess in particular, was there another route directly out of the Bernie movement, out of these discussions? Were there proposals on the table? Were there things that embodied this model, or was it kind of from the beginning it seemed like it was going to go down the route of our revolution? And I'm not saying these groups, especially locally, there's a lot of good work being done under that banner, so I don't mean to denigrate.
I agree. I think there's our revolution, the national umbrella, and then there are many, many affiliates, and many of them are organizations that existed before our revolution, and there are tons of people doing amazing work. I think that that sort of structure of that sort of big organizing structure existed on the Bernie campaign too, and was a problem during the Bernie campaign. And it actually, in some ways, the volunteer groups were given this autonomy because there were no staff in most of the states. I can mostly speak to New York. There was no staff in New York until about a month before the primary. So it was this great opportunity to have all this autonomy and build and grow. Which worked in places where there were people who had organizing experience and sort of knew what to do, but maybe didn't work as well in places where that base of experience wasn't there. But I think that I don't think a model nationally came out of the Bernie campaign that I think works. I do a lot of work with DSA now, and that to me is the closest to what I see as democratically owning the product of your work. So everything at DSA is very democratic. It's very structured, though. So I don't mean horizontal in the sense that, there's no structure. There's a ton of structure, but big decisions are made democratically. The people doing the work are the ones who have the most decision-making power. And I think, at least in New York City, there's definitely a lot of discussion about how do we own the product of our work. So we're not just a campaign. Just to give an example, a campaign doesn't sweep into town and say, hey, you guys are aligned with us. We need you to knock on some doors and make some calls. We all do that. We all do that work. They get all of the data. They get all of that information about who supports this. And then they leave town or they separate. And us, as a grassroots movement, start from scratch in a way the next time another campaign comes along. And that's what we're trying to avoid.
No, I think I think we'll return to some of these questions a little bit after. But Paul, to start with, I guess I also want you to give a little biographical kind of introduction to that context is useful. And one of the points that we discussed earlier was this idea that right now, obviously, the left is for very good reason responding to the immediate outrages of the Trump administration, and God knows there are many, and they happen, you know, every you know, day it seems. But I guess during the Bernie campaign, before that, in Occupy, there was certain moments when we were foregrounding and talking about particular structures, like the role of finance, the role of these different segments of capital. And, you know, the left began thinking kind of these bigger questions. Who owns what? What do they do with that power? How do we get it back? And it was a little bit less of a defensive posture at the moment. So I wanted to kind of touch on that question of how do we go back to, first of all, how do we, in this moment when everything is defensive, go on the offensive, and how do we start thinking and educating ourselves in these basic things. And, you know, me, like, I myself only understood the rudiments of political economy, for instance, because I decided it was important as a, you know, as a socialist to learn basic, you know, macroeconomic, you know, like, what does the Fed do? You know, how does monetary policy work? And so on. Is there a way we, one, incorporate that popular education, but also make it an integral part of the organizing we're actually doing? That's a big question.
Yeah, it's a big question. I thought it'd be fun to operate anonymously, but I guess I'll give a little bit of an introduction. I come from sort of both of the last two speakers' worlds. I was a co-organizer with Tasha during the Bernie Sanders campaign with Team Bernie New York. And I also do work with Democracy at Work as editor of their website and as a commentator. And I also am the electoral politics chair and part of the coordinating committee of our New York Action Group. So to answer your big question, Bhaskar, so I think that, the sort of the global emerging right wing authoritarianism and fascism can be explained by the failure of the global economic system, particularly post 2008 financial crisis. I think that, however, you know, since the financial crisis, with the exception of Occupy Wall Street, as you mentioned, and the Bernie Sanders bid for president, the magnitude of the financial sector and the power that it has not been challenged by the wider left social movements. And you know, one of the positive outcomes of Trump, obviously, is that there's a lot of things going on politically right now, and a lot of people have certainly woken up. But a lot of the stuff that's happening are it's really detours around core economic issues. And so, for example, I mean, where are the sort of mass demonstrations or protests or marches, around income inequality, around CEO and worker pay disparity. Where's the working class or labor movements right now? Where are the where's the backlash against the privatization of our infrastructure, of our natural resources, and so forth? And I think the answer is pretty simple. It's a result of the financial system's opacity and then sort of the inaccessibility to greater society. If a society cannot see it or they cannot understand it, then they can't possibly challenge it or change it. And this makes us very, very vulnerable to the system with which we live in. We already see it now. There's rampant inequality. There's instability in our economic system. There's precarious work. Lack of basic needs and access to things such as healthcare and so forth. And I think that any future mass movement today must play a crucial role in mobilizing people by educating them on how the economic system really works. And that doesn't mean that everyone needs to become a professor of economics, but we need to establish alliances with experts who share our political orientation. And we must come up with an accessible framework and analysis for people to understand how the economy works. And I think that will be incredibly powerful. I think that it was Henry Ford back in the 1930s said something like that, if people really understood how our banking and monetary system worked, there'd be a revolution before tomorrow morning. I'm not usually quoting capitalists, but I think there's a lot of truth in that. The one thing that I do fear right now is that if we don't establish this economic framework on the left, I fear that it will sort of get co-opted by the Clinton and Obama neoliberal politics that we've had. We can't just be anti-Trump, because when we're just anti-Trump, then we're just in defense of the same neoliberal system that we're living under right now.
But on the question of expertise, on the question of expertise, though, I guess obviously in the abstract it's a great sentiment, but what's the mechanism to actually deliver this knowledge and training? Because traditionally we would say, okay, most of this political education was done by two forms in the history of the left. It was done by trade unions and it was done by political parties. Obviously in the U.S. we have a small, declining labor movement, much of which is not necessarily interested in radical political education, with a couple exceptions. And obviously we don't have a party or that kind of apparatus. It's one of the great failure of our workers' movement, of which there are dozens of depressing books dedicated to. So is there a new kind of organ for the dissemination of these ideas? Do you see a lot of this happening digitally? How do you?
I think when you compare it to past historical similar struggles, I think that they obviously didn't have the same amount of access to information, and people weren't able to organize in entirely different places geographically. But I think there's a lot, and this is like this can be said of the entire left. I think that everyone's kind of focused on their own sort of little issues in sort of silos. And there's actually a lot of movements going on specifically, not just sort of in the heterodox economics world, but there's actually students all across the globe who are challenging the economics profession, because the economics profession is in a state of crisis. It's one of the reasons why they couldn't accurately predict the financial crisis. So a good group would be out of Manchester University in England called Rethinking Economics, which has now built global chapters where students are actually challenging their economic departments to be more pluralistic and not to just engaging in one discipline of economics, which is the prevailing one, which is neoclassical economics right now, which is sort of where our policy is coming from. I think to answer your question very simply, I think technology helps. I think digital sort of organizing helps. I think there's just a vast amount of information out there that we didn't have when compared to past sort of struggles. But I think it's going to take sustained planning and establishment of a lot of different silo groups working on similar things.
Our last speaker, Karina Garcia, has one of the more, we just met, but she's been involved in immigrant rights work, reproductive justice work, anti-war work, anti-austerity work around education and whatnot. So please also properly introduce yourself. But I know good leftists are modest, but everyone on this panel is very accomplished. Except for me, I just sit home and, read and doodle all day. That doesn't much. But I guess particularly, now, a lot of your work now focuses around the question of how do we build political independence? How do we take a lot of the struggles and the momentum and all of the anger and energy that was emerging around Trump but prevent it from just becoming another elect Democrats in the next midterm election movement. Maybe a little bit out of kind of the lessons that some of us drew from the Iraq war movement in that period where immediate mass mobilizations kind of petered out, not even in 2008 when Barack Obama was elected, but kind of started to even a little bit before. So how do we maintain that momentum, especially when it seems like third-party efforts in the U.S. have obviously not had a very good history. We've had one great third-party effort, and the good news was it helped usher about a revolution that destroyed slavery. The bad news is that party's in power now, and Donald Trump's at the head of it. But
okay, good. Hi, everybody. Can you hear me okay? How's everybody feeling? Humor me for a minute. How's everybody feeling? All right, I want to hear with a little more energy, like we just had lunch and we're feeling strong and we're feeling powerful. How's everybody feeling? There we go. Thank you. You want me to stand up? Okay. Stand up. All right, I got you. So my name is Karina Garcia. I'm a Chicana from Southern California. My parents are Mexican immigrants. My father came to this country when he was 16 years old, undocumented, and many of my family members were undocumented. So I grew up, even though, I grew up in the United States, I had that many family members who were undocumented and were afraid to open the doors and were afraid that if they were going to be stopped by the police, that was it. They were going to be separated from their families. I grew up in a family that was very working class. My grandmother lived in Section 8 housing. I lived with her for a long time. She had an accident when she was a fast food worker working at a Carl's Jr. And she had an accident and she had to get a neck surgery for a long time. And so she really benefited from going to, I remember what it was like to go into the welfare office and to get food stamps. And I remember the shame that we would feel going into the grocery store. And when I think about the attacks that Donald Trump is presenting and the impact that that's going to have on millions of people, poor and working people of all nationalities around the country, it drives me crazy to think about it. Because I know what a nothing our social services really are compared to the amount of wealth that our communities produce in society as a whole, right? And so to me, I feel that this is, it's so important right now that we come out and that we're not feeling ashamed of benefiting from food stamps, that we have nothing to be ashamed about. The real thieves are the people on Wall Street, the people who benefit from evicting people out of their homes. Jared Kushner, the slumlord. Those are the people who should feel ashamed. The people who should feel ashamed are those who benefited from years and years of unpaid labor, that those of slavery, that those are the people, that's how they got rich, that's how these banks got their wealth. The people who get 300 times, the average CEO gets 300 times the salary of the average worker. That's why we're poor, because they're so rich, right? Are we to believe that they work 300 times as hard as we do? Do they work 300 times harder than domestic workers and janitors and teachers and construction workers and immigrants? Do they work harder than 300 times harder than all of those people? No. We don't live in a poor country. We live in the richest country in the world, and yet one in two people is living in poverty. We're tired of being humiliated. We're tired of living in poverty in the richest country in the world. We're tired of our tax dollars going to drop bombs on other countries. They tell us they don't have money for education. They tell us they don't have money for health care. They don't have money for housing, but they have hundreds of billions of dollars to drop bombs on people in other countries. So we shouldn't feel ashamed. We should not feel ashamed. This country is rich off of the backs of our labor, and we want it back. And so we should not feel defeated. We should not feel defeated. We should look at what's been happening in this country. Look at what's been happening since September 11th. We've seen the mass mobilizations against the war. We've seen immigrant workers in 2006, the people who everybody said were the most afraid because they had so much to lose, were the most exploited, living in the shadows. Those people came out and had the biggest demonstrations in U.S. history. And they shut down this country in small cities, in large cities, all across the country. They brought back May Day. The people who everyone said were the most afraid, the sleeping giant. Well, we've never been sleeping. We have never been sleeping, but we're waking up now. We are flexing our muscles now. All across the country, you see people who are fighting in the Black Lives Matter movement, who've been coming out. The Fight for 15, that wasn't politicians. That was workers who were risking already getting paid poverty wages and still coming out and putting that campaign out, right? Those are our people. Those people are resisting all around the country. What we're trying to do is get those people together and organize those people so that we're fighting for the same thing. Right? So we should not feel pessimistic at all. There are so many people that we've been seeing around the country that have been resisting. The people who are fighting for their communities, who are standing up against racist police brutality, against mass incarceration, against the deportation of immigrants, people who are standing up and putting their bodies on the line to protect Muslim people who are being harassed by racist thugs. Those people are out there. We just have to get organized. We just have to bring them all together under one program. And that's what we're trying to do. That's what we're trying to do here. There was a question you probably asked. I want to just quickly tell you about the People's Congress of Resistance, which is happening in Washington, D.C. on September 16th and 17th. We are trying to bring those people together. All those people who around the country have been resisting, we are trying to bring those people together so that we can come up with a platform that says what the people deserve, not what they think that we should get. Not the scraps that they think we should get, but all of the pie, the whole thing. Because we make this country run, we should run this country.
Oh. Now I got a follow up. I'm all right. I can't follow that. I'll be louder. At the beginning of the weekend, all right. But at this point, it's been a long weekend. But so concretely though,
yeah.
Does that mean that, can we have, let's say, the same platform you laid out? Let's say, as a hypothetical, and God knows I would rather do almost anything else but this, but let's say hypothetically, if let's say Christian wanted to run as mayor in, that's a bad example, if you wanted to run for city council, let's say, in a seat in Brooklyn, and he wants to do so in the same platform as you, on a socialist platform, and explicitly says, I'm a socialist, I'm funded from outside sources, not from the same sources that fund most Democratic Party candidates, not from the banks, but from small donors. If he was accountable to a socialist organization, or organization like PSL, like Social Alternative, like DSA, any organization, would there be a difference? Would it be okay if you ran a Democratic primary as opposed to creating your own party? And if you do think this the independent ballot line is important, how do we kind of begin to overcome the barriers for making it, you know, happen?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So I think when we run, look, we want to fight wherever the fighters are. We want to be next to them. Because we know that ultimately it's important for us to read and to study and to sharpen up and to know what it is that we're fighting for, right? We have to be clear about it. We say what we're fighting for. It's socialism. What is socialism? It's not a big, scary thing. It's not a complicated thing. And you know what? Our people are smart. So there's nothing too complicated for our people anyway. So we don't have to run away from talking about big concepts as if our people can't understand them, right? What is socialism? It's a society that's run for the benefit of poor and working class people, where poor and working class people are in power, where the economy is organized to meet the needs of the people and the planet. That's it. If we had the power of the media, so many millions of people would be with us. They would, if they could vote for those things, they would vote for those things. But we know that the political system is rigged, that the electoral system is rigged, that it's been set up against us, and that it's damn near impossible to do any kind of change within it, because they set it up that way, right? They set it up that way. How else would a tiny percentage of the population be able to control vast amount of resources, be able to control the rest of the, not just this country, but the planet? How else but to create a system that protects their privileges, right? A system and a state that puts our people down the minute that we're starting to organize and rise up, right? So we understand that the electoral system is set up against us, that we're not going to win through that system. But that doesn't mean that we ignore that. Because if people are fighting there, then I want to stand and I want to fight with those people, with them, alongside those people too. And so we can be clear about what the electoral system is, how it is rigged against poor and working people. But that doesn't mean that we just stand on the sidelines and just leave the politics to the experts, the quote-unquote experts. No. We want to be on that stage debating those people, putting out our program, our ideas. And we can't do that if we're not involved. We can't do that if we're not involved in the fight for reform. And if that means running a candidate to be able to draw attention, to put out socialist ideas, what is socialism, to talk about that in an audience, right? To be able to do campaigning that we're talking about, we're not lying about, we're not making illusions about the system, we're being honest about the system. Most people already know it's corrupt. Most people don't even vote because they know it doesn't make a difference anyway. So most people are already there. The problem is we don't want those people to be apathetic. We don't want them not to be involved. We want them to be involved in something else, something that can truly lead to their liberation. And that is only the struggle. That's the only thing that's going to do it. We know that time and time again in history, the only times that things change is when poor and working class people struggle. Protests, demonstrations, sit-ins, strikes, that's how we win. That's the only way that we win. And in fact, the sooner that we stop thinking that we need to change the politicians' minds and start knowing that we need to change our people's minds, that's when things are going to change. The system changes when the people change. And the people change when they see something worth fighting for, that they can fight for something. And we've seen all these examples in the immigrant rights movement. We've seen people lose their fear and come out and demonstrate. But then those efforts have been misdirected back into the Democratic Party. And I was involved in 2006 in all of those demonstrations, and I saw what they did. I remember it so vividly how it happened. They said, today we march and tomorrow we vote. And that's the way that they demobilized us. We were out there protesting in the streets. We were out there in doing strikes. We had the Day Without an Immigrant was a strike in May 2006. And then they said, no, stop focusing on organizing your, making your demands, but you focus on the elections, get us elected, and we'll do it. And that's when we lose. We lose our power when we hand it over to them. And we just do this vote. Thank you. In the back, you feel me. And that's what happened. And in 2006, it was all, si se puede, si se puede. And when Obama got elected, no se puede. No se pudo. No se pudo. And I'm never going to forget that. And I'm always going to talk about it. And I'm always going to remind people about that. The Democratic Party are not our friends. They're our enemies. They're the other side of the Republican Party. They're the people who are oppressing our communities. I don't give a fuck about the Democratic Party. I'm not trying to have them grow. I'm trying to build our own organizations, have our own representatives, real power. We need working people to be involved. Not to, like you said, I love what you said, Tasha, about we're not doing all this work just to build up this one person. No, we're doing this because we need the liberation of our whole community. What has it really helped me to have a Chicana from California to be the president of the United States when millions of Chicanos and Chicanas are poor? If we don't change the economic system, it doesn't matter that I have a representation of me. Like, that can go a little bit, that's a little bit good, like it helps my self-esteem, but it doesn't protect my family from poverty, right? And one in two people in this country are at or near poverty, so there's a lot of people who have a lot of investment in a new system. We just got to talk about that system. We got to talk about socialism. When we're fighting, the ones who are fighting this good fight, we need to say, we are socialists. The people who fight, who have a vision for something different, they're socialists. We're not trying to go around in circles for the rest of our lives. That's what happens with the Democratic Party. We get out in the street and start fighting, start making changes, and then they try to bring us back. We've been through that road. We're going to another road. This is a road that it's a new road in some ways. We have some examples that we can learn from. We can learn from the Cubans. We can learn from the Russians. We can learn from the people who have done it. It's a new road, but at least it's somewhere. It goes to somewhere. So that's what I got to say.
So there's a few questions here, but I want to actually pose that question just in a couple sentences. I'll do a few kind of a rapid fire round, starting with Christian, I guess, going down. I guess the first question being, the immediate task, I guess, let's say three scenarios, and I can guess what you all say on kind of all of them, but one, is there a route to transform the Democratic Party? B is, assuming that we don't think that it's possible to transform the Democratic Party, is there some possible strategic use in using primaries? Or C, is the answer immediate, independent political action through a third party, you know, bids right away, assuming that we all share the same or similar kind of end goal? I know it's a big question, but
yeah, it's also not my area of expertise at all. But it seems to me that there are places in which the Democratic Party at the local level really is open to being taken over or at least heavily influenced by socialists. And in a city like San Francisco, the entire thing is the Democratic primary. So in situations like that, I think it's important to, try and influence those structures and even try and take over the local Democratic Party. And that has been published in the pages of Jacobin, right? I mean, the Democratic Party isn't a kind of membership-based party with a central leadership. It's a much stranger thing. And so at local levels, I think there are openings for it. In terms of the national project of the Democratic Party, yeah, it is what it appears to be, right? It's a totally unaccountable corporate party. And very crucially, I just read Shattered, which is not that good a book, but it paints detailed pictures just how truly without ideas the leadership are, right? It's not just that we don't like the ideas, they have bad ideas. Those are like really arrogantly ignorant people. So obviously trying to influence the national center of the Democratic Party from the inside is a ridiculous idea. But at the local level, I think we should have a more nuanced and regionally specific set of agendas.
What do you think?
I don't care about the Democratic Party one way or the other. If the opportunity arises to do something in and with it, fine. And if the opportunity that looks better for us is to go outside the Democratic Party, fine. I once ran for mayor of New Haven, Connecticut, and also ran for the city council there. So I've done this kind of work. And when I ran for the city council, I got 47% of the vote. But that was because the Republican Party endorsed me, even though I ran on the Green Party line. What I'm trying to say is what we in the left lack and need, and the scare and the fear about it runs so deep, it's always amazing to me. We need our own independent organization. We have to be able to overcome a half century of deeply sedimented anxiety about being part of a left-wing organization. There's no mystery about why that happened. That was the post-World War II destruction of the Communist Party, the two Socialist Party, and while it took a little longer, the labor movement. That's been done. And nobody in this room and nobody in this country has escaped the deep-seated, often unconscious anxiety about being part of a general left-wing organization that unifies all the different interests we've been talking about for the last 2 hours, or rather, for the last 2.5 days, into an organization of all of us helping each other as we each go about looking for and finding the opportunities to push it forward. In the Democratic Party, in the Republican Party, wherever, at the workplace, in the baseball team, doesn't matter. This fight is the same. We'll be stronger if those of us in one area can share experiences with those of us in the other. And in order to do that, you have to have, oh boy, here comes, a centralized organization that's able and willing to have those meetings, have those discussions, do the coordinating, struggle through the difficult decisions. But if we all live in the world where this is dismissed as some Stalinist evil, then we are immobilizing ourselves, and the discussion about whether or not the Democratic Party is the end of the line, not where we should be starting.
Yeah, organizations don't exist to run candidates in elections. Organizations exist to produce politics, and that sometimes means running candidates in elections. But I guess, Tasha, I want same question, kind of your thoughts, and both your thoughts, and maybe some, if you could give us a glimpse of some of maybe the discussions within DSA, within the electoral working group here, or?
Yeah, definitely. I do actually agree with the centralized organization part, despite my skepticism about big organizing. As long as the centralized organization is taking its leads from the people doing the work locally on the ground. I think there's a real danger in sort of sitting at the top and thinking that you know what's happening on the ground. And I think both the Bernie campaign and the Hillary campaign lost because of that dynamic, just being separated from what was actually happening on the ground in very different ways, but I think it was the same thing. I think on the left, oftentimes we get into these arguments of like, which way is better, this way or this way, and it's this sort of like very polarizing thing. When I think oftentimes, these two things are complementary and can help each other. I definitely feel like New York City, to Christian's point, local politics, I think there are a lot of opportunities to sort of break in. I think that right now, DSA has a really interesting, we're in an interesting space. To talk about DSA for a second, we have actually very recently endorsed a city council candidate who identifies as a socialist in Bay Ridge, who would be the first Arab American city council member in New York City, and is a DSA member. So there's that. And then we also just the other day endorsed a city council candidate in the Green Party. Sorry, the Bay Ridge candidate is a Democrat. We also just endorsed a city council candidate who also identifies as a socialist, is also an active DSA member, who's running on the Green Party in District 35, which is Crown Heights. So we have two different versions, and I think it's going to be really exciting this year to see how this plays out. But I think why I really like it, and this is one of the things that really pulled me into DSA, is that there isn't this way or this way and nothing in between. There's a great diversity of opinions and perspectives within DSA and a lot of debate about this. And we've created a democratic environment that has given us the space to see what works. And maybe both works, because Bay Ridge is very different than Crown Heights. DSA's membership in Bay Ridge is very different than Crown Heights. And I think there are always going to be local dynamics that change the answer to your question. And so in my mind, there's a different answer depending on the locality of where you are, which is why it's so important that the people on the ground are the ones determining what strategy there is.
Paul, do you want to tackle this one?
Yeah, my answer might be a little bit shorter. I think I kind of share a similar view to everyone in a certain way. I think there are certainly opportunities to be made in local elections. And, you know, I'm not going to make a naive sort of statement and say that, of course, electoral politics, all the way up from the lowest level to the presidency, are incredibly important. It's just the reality of the political system that we currently live in right now, you know, to enact legislation and put certain policies in place. But I do think, and we tend to ignore a lot of our history in this country, and I really don't think that there's been any major transformation without a social movement. And so I share the view that there should be some sort of centralized organization pushing, obviously, those social movements. But to get back to the history point, I think Rick makes this point a lot better than I do, but during the Great Depression, we were told that there was no money to go around, right? And working class people, three different groups, the AFL-CIO, Socialist Party, and the Communist Party, put pressure on FDR, and in a time in the midst of the greatest depression or country has ever seen, what are the things that he came out with? Social Security, a massive federal jobs program, and the minimum wage. I think there needs to be a hybrid of things going on here. But I think sustained social movements are critical, especially in our times right now.
Just the CIO at that point, things got a little bit worse when it became the AFL-CIO and they kicked us out. It just struck me that a lot of us on this panel have been using kind of the S word to describe our politics, and maybe this is kind of a sign of maybe where a lot of the left is at in 2017, but maybe 10 years ago, if we had this discussion, it would have been kind of more eclectic, where some people preferring green or progressive, some people talking about anarchism or socialism. So feel free to pass on this question, but I was wondering if, starting with Karina, whether you were Whether you think there's a, whether it's just kind of a label, or you think there's a difference in our politics or orientation if we say socialist as opposed to broadly on the left, or does that have the potential to bring up kind of old, not very productive divisions? And again, big question, you know, short answers would be good, or you could just say pass and I could think of something else.
Yeah, no, that's so good. I like that question. I think the spirit of Tasha, what you were saying about, like, it just depends on who you're talking to. I think we have to be smart, and we have to be, like, paying attention and listening, be good organizers and listening to our communities and decide. Like, when, I feel like it's kind of like a little bit of a balance. It's like you have to decide, like, when are you going to challenge yourself, and at the same time, when do you need to protect yourself? And I do feel like we're at a time right now, and I know that historically it's not always been this way, but we're at that time right now. And so I think more and more people, it's easier to say you're a socialist. And for some people, for some older folks, there might be more history and more sort of skepticism about it. But for a lot of young people, they are more in favor of socialism than capitalism right now. Like, that's what we've been seeing. That was one of the most phenomenal things in the last few years that we've been seeing. So I feel like in this context, like, you should challenge yourself as much as you can to identify yourself as a socialist, so that we can talk about what is our vision, what are we fighting for, and we don't just have to talk about the problems. And I think that one of my comrades said this before, and I think he's so true, it's so true. We have to go out and offer the solutions that meet the scale of the problem. Solutions that meet the scale of the problem. And but that's politics, that at certain moments, maybe you might be afraid to talk about a certain thing, but like, the scale of the problem, like right now, if we're talking about healthcare, right? Like, the scale of the problem with healthcare right now is immense. That if you talk about universal single-payer healthcare, that's not that hard. People are for that. We should talk about that. And that is part of a socialist program, right? People would like that. So I think, you know, if you're in a context, like, in the last year, I've been reading those opinion polls about keep people identifying themselves as socialists, and with the Sanders campaign, it made it a lot easier to do it, and I've been challenging myself to do it, and everybody at my job knows that I'm a socialist. And that is different from the last few years. And so all the people that I meet, that I work with, who respect the work that I'm doing as an activist, they know I'm a socialist, and they ask me about it now. And that's what I'm trying to do that as much as possible. And sometimes you don't have to lead with that. I think people can decide if they want to talk about themselves as leftist or say the word progressive, but that we're sort of taking advantage of this opportunity that we have right now to popularize socialism, what socialism means, who we are, what we're trying to really fight for, as much as possible.
Yeah. Anyone else? You guys all want to take it down the list? Maybe?
I keep passing it.
Yeah, that's okay. I'm happy to see.
So yeah, I agree with a lot of what Karina said. I think that if you want to call yourself a socialist, that's absolutely fine. I think that's a positive thing. And I think, you know, Bernie Sanders, we have the world to thank to him for that. He certainly opened up the door to something different than capitalism. And I think that's the point. I mean, I think we need to, in whatever movements or organizations come out of this, or alternative viable sort of parties or whatever, we need to provide a sharp contrast to the economic system that we live under right now, which is capitalism. So I'm more focused on the agenda, and that agenda has to be a reorganization of our political and economic system that is firmly anti-capitalist. But certainly, I mean, I think at a place like the Left Forum here, where you have activists working on all sorts of different things and coming from all sorts of different ideologies and backgrounds, certainly not everyone here does label themselves a socialist. They might be, like you said, anarchists, or they might call themselves anti-capitalists or leftists. But I think the one thing that you know, our commonality is our sort of economic existence, and I think that's the one thing sort of uniting us. So I think it needs to be, you know, about the agenda, and I think that agenda needs to be contrasting what we're living under right now.
I love this question. I think that it's definitely, there's been a huge shift in the last couple of years. It's not a scary word anymore, and it's been popularized, and as Karina said, especially with young people. I personally don't really identify as anything, which is a little weird for me. I'm in Democratic Socialist, so I have this debate with people that I work with there all the time, to Paul's point, I'm pretty focused on policies and specific issues. So I love talking about single-payer healthcare, for example, free CUNY, all sorts of stuff. And I'm totally comfortable and fine talking about socialism. I think I get very cautious about anything that puts me in a box and makes it harder for me to talk to people, because when I go out there, I just like, thank you. When I go out there, I like to just, whoever I'm talking to, find a way to relate to them, and I'm just very hesitant to define myself as anything because of that. I don't define myself as a Democrat. I don't define myself really as anything. So it's more of the question that I avoid than any kind of specific hesitancy about socialism or the word. I'm comfortable being around it, and obviously I support a lot of issues that would be considered socialist issues. But I think the label, just having any label, bothers me, because I like to be able to just see what people have to say and see how best I can relate without that.
For 200 years, the capitalist system has had to deal with people who call themselves socialists. During that time, it has been very creative. It has killed large numbers of them. It has imprisoned large numbers of them. It has silenced them in countless ways. But the monster will not die. And that's an important understanding, because socialism, not the narrow definition of that we're worried about with the labels, and that was well spoken, and I agree with that, not that narrow thing, that's part of the effort to destroy it, pinning it down to this or that narrow perspective. But the reason that the capitalists can't destroy socialism is that socialism is their shadow. They're like children. You can't sweep it away. It's part of you. Socialism is the reaction to capitalism that says, it stinks. It's no good. We can do better. And if socialists understood the incredible success that was just spoken up here, that young people, and it's correct, we have all the polls to show it, that young people in America, feeling that the capitalist system has let them down, are beginning to look at and read and talk about socialism, that's just a reaffirmation of what it's shown itself to be able to do for 200 years. We got nothing to worry about. We're here because we are the shadow of this system, which it cannot shake. It's only up to us to learn, as Tasha says, to make it a broad, open, welcoming way for those who share the notion we can do better than capitalism to find a home in the socialist organizations we build.
I think we should use the word socialism. I think that Bernie was brilliant in doing that, and he's really created a lot of space. And he also showed a sort of a way to entice regular people into this idea. And it's sort of like the idea of socialism as a slippery slope, rather than socialism as this all or none thing we transition to. But to begin with, what I argue at least, is to point out that socialism or socialistic features of our economy already exist and are in fact absolutely central to the production and reproduction of capitalism. I mean, this is Carl Polanyi's point, right? That if you really had market society, where society was totally subordinated to the logic of the market, everything would fall apart. You'd have total anarchy. That's absolutely true. Capital needs an outside. It needs unpaid labor power that expropriates at the point of production. It needs the gifts of quote-unquote nature, unpaid utilities that are taken and not produced, taken from nature. And it receives enormous, hidden in plain sight, subsidies from the public sector. I mean, that is like the entire economic history of capitalist development. If you look at any successfully industrialized capitalist economy, in none of these stories does it happen without massive intervention and subsidies and support by the state. And now that's a kind of socialism for the creation of capitalist markets and private accumulation, but it's an important point to make to people to make them realize that actually the society they live in already in many ways depends on socialism. That capitalists were unable to create roads, they're unable to reproduce the system in any number of ways, and that there's a kind of modern commons that exists, this shadow socialism, that we have to defend and also expand. And I know there have been a number of really good panels at Left Forum this year that have talked about this, the idea of expanding the realm of decommodified production and services. The discussion of universal basic income got into that. So anyway, yeah, I think that we should call ourselves socialists, and I think we should be talking about Marxism. And the way I always sort of smuggle that in with my students is by saying, look, if you want to understand capitalism, you don't have to be a socialist, whatever. If you love capitalism, you want to go into business, fine. But look, if you want to understand it, you need this intellectual tradition, because otherwise you will not be able to really understand how it works. And then that frequently is a kind of, as it were, kind of intellectual gateway drug to heavier stuff. So, yes.
Yeah. Otherwise, it would just be a curious, like, audio tape series, like, you know, Marx for MBAs or something.
Yes. That would be very interesting.
I mean, just as an intervention that no one wants from me, you know, being socialist for me was always kind of, or having kind of a socialist, like Marxist worldview, at least in its essentials, was basically just sharing this kind of, one, a moral and ethical critique of capitalism. So there is a system out there, because if you read like Wall Street Journal and stuff, capitalism doesn't actually get mentioned. It's like the economy, right? It's just the, you know, it's the unnamed system, but there is a system out there that that's based on hierarchy and oppression and exploitation, and we're against it. And also there's, like Rick says, a plausible alternative out there. We can build something better. But also what I do think is kind of concrete in this vision is that there is a road to get from here to there. And there is a big difference between, let's say, saying we're going to get a better wage for workers by making some sort of like corporatist, like, you know, agreement between state business and labor unions kind of behind closed doors or whatever, and saying we're going to do it from below, from struggle and whatnot. And to me, that vision was always, you know, encapsulated in the socialist tradition. I didn't want to actually have the last word, but, you know, 15 minutes ago, a world historic event started. Does anyone know what happened?
No.
Game 2 of the NBA Finals started. So our speakers will be around for a little bit on the way out, you know, so I'm sure we can spark up more conversations and whatnot. I wanted to once again thank all of our speakers. Thank you all for coming, and especially to thank the Left Forum organizers.